And good evening, Portland. The time is 6 o'clock, and this is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs. That's coming up right after these messages.
Blue. Songs are like tattoos.
This is Ed Melnick inviting you to join me for a special focus on early Joni Mitchell. Joining me for some Joni talk will be singer-songwriters Ann Weiss, Bree Gregg, and Sue Zalikar. 3 p.m. this Monday, November 4th, on the singer-songwriter edition of the Monday Sampler.
Call me at the station. The lights are open.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Visegrad Group PDX Festival, November 9th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. To celebrate the 95th anniversary of independence of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian nations, this one-day festival will share traditions, history, arts, and crafts, and national food of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian communities within Multnomah County. Again, the Visegrad Group PDX Festival will take place at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue, on Saturday, November 9th, from 1 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from True West, presenting an evening with Emmy Lou Harris and Rodney Crowell with Richard Thompson, November 4th at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. Tickets for Emmy Lou Harris on November 4th available at portland5.com.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs, on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, making it the longest-running feminist radio program in the country. The Bread and Roses airspace is shared among a collective and open to all woman-identified people who want to get involved behind the scenes or in front of the mic. We provide free training and mentorship to support you in bringing your personal vision to the airwaves. We believe women's issues are all-encompassing and include the personal, political, cultural, and beyond. For more information and to check out podcasts of previous shows, visit us on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/breadandroses. And you can check us out on Facebook under KBOO Bread and Roses. If interested in joining us, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at volunteer@kboo.org. I'm your host this week, Leanne Kranz. Tonight's show is in two parts. At 6:30, Delphine Crescenzo interviews Jackie Blackman-Forché of Women Under Siege, to discuss the rape crisis in Syria. And first, we'll air an interview with acclaimed writer Elizabeth Gilbert, author of the international bestseller Eat, Pray, Love, and the new novel, The Signature of All Things. In this new work, Her intention was to rewrite the 19th century women's novel, which historically offers women characters one of two endings, either matrimony and motherhood, or social ruin and death, literature's own virgin whore complex. Instead, Gilbert explores what happens to a woman who follows neither path. In The Signature of All Things, the main character, Alma Whitaker, is born to a world that just does not value her. She is not considered beautiful. She's too tall, intelligent, and outspoken to attract suitors. And yet, she develops a flourishing life of the mind. She pursues the only scientific field open to women in the 1800s, condescendingly called polite botany. She's confined to the grounds of her father's estate, but finds a kindred spirit in the study of moss, an undervalued phylum, unnoticed, uninteresting. Yet, upon closer examination, she discovers that moss is the natural world in miniature, a microcosm of the universe. In a word, fascinating. And so is the life of Alma Whitaker. Elizabeth Gilbert's The Signature of All Things is written with the author's characteristic exuberance and is above all an adventure story, but a woman's exploration this time, and definitely not for children. Elizabeth will be in Portland next week, Wednesday night, as part of the Voices Lecture Series, and unfortunately, that event is now sold out. But Elizabeth took time out of her recent book tour to speak with me about the new novel and why she is honored to call herself a feminist. Here is our conversation. In a recent interview about your new book, The Signature of All Things, you said that you wanted to rewrite the 19th century women's novel. How did this shape your story, the story of your main character, Alma Whitaker?
The primary way is what I didn't want to happen to her. It seems like, well, actually, I can say pretty firmly that in every 19th century novel, there's only one of two endings that women get for their lives. They either get the good marriage to landed gentry, or they are, you know, ruined and under the wheels of a train because of some sensual error that they made that was so destructive that they can never recover from it. So they're either exiled from society or murdered or suicide. So there's the sort of happy ending, which means that you got rescued by a man, and there's the sad ending, which means that you got ruined by a man. And I just feel like it's inauthentic to most women's experiences, not only then but now, that women's lives are a lot more complicated than that. And there's a lot in between rescue and ruin, and in that very wide in-between is, I think, where most of us live. And the women who I've always been most fascinated with are the ones who are tremendously resilient, despite the fact that they may not have gotten everything that they wanted.
Yes, I like in the same interview in Oprah magazine, you said that you wanted to write a story of someone who didn't get everything they wanted. And I thought you did a really beautiful job, not only of displaying the complexity and the interesting life that Alma was able to develop in a, quote, small life, you know, geographically, in terms of relationships and adventures, it could be considered small. You did a beautiful job of comparing that as a metaphorical parallel to her beloved moss.
Yeah.
Do you mind talking about how moss relates to Alma's, quote, small life?
Sure. I mean, what I wanted to do when I set out to write this book, one of my other motives was that I wanted to write a book about a woman of towering intellect who loves her work and who is saved by her work. That's something that's really dear to me, and it's also something that I found when I started to do research on 19th century female botanists, that their personal lives might have been difficult or disappointing or sometimes even unhappy, but their work seemed to be this place of real safety for them, and real power and real creativity. So I wanted to give Alma that. And I needed to find something that she could plausibly have studied that was expansive and complicated enough a plant that she could have gotten to some of the same answers and questions that the great male botanist parts of the day were asking, but that was plentiful and nearby and underfoot so that she wouldn't have to leave her father's estate in order to study it. And moss became a candidate for me. It was something that she could have studied. I had a feeling it was going to be either moss or ferns. And once I started looking into moss, I realized it's perfect because it's the universe writ in miniature. Mm. And I think that that's often what women's lives have been, are these sort of divine miniaturized lives, you know, where instead of doing the Sistine Chapel, they're doing like needlepoint on this tiny, almost microscopic level, these great acts of creativity that are compressed either by the fact that they don't have time to work on it, or they don't have the right materials, or that it has to be hidden. And so moss felt like the sort of botanical equivalent of the kind of work that women have always done in order to keep themselves from going mad.
I love that. Thank you. Thank you for writing this book, by the way. It was just refreshing.
I had such a good time writing it.
I could tell. You know, it read like a burst of creativity.
Thank you so much. It was a great joy and a great pleasure to write.
You also raised some very interesting thoughts, I would say, about the role of science and spirituality in truly understanding this life on Earth. Currently, science and spirituality have a very uneasy relationship. And was that always the case in your research? What did you uncover about the initial relationship between science and spirituality?
Well, this is something that I found really fascinating in my research, is that for most of Western history, there has been no difference whatsoever between science and spirituality. And for that matter, you could also include the arts, and you could say that I think you could say very reasonably that the arts and science and spirituality for most of our human history have all been the same thing. You know, they've all been about trying to decode the mysteries of our existence and our consciousness and to answer, you know, what are we here for? How do things work? You know, what elevates us? What makes us better? Those are the questions that they've always asked. And then in the 19th century, it was like there was this huge explosion in the middle of the 19th century, starting even before Darwin, where it started to become quite evident that the scientific record and the biblical record did not match up. Mm-hmm. And you can see that it was really causing disastrous turmoil in people's personal lives to begin to put that together. And people were starting to have to choose sides. And I think that from Darwin on, it's almost as though there was this terrible divorce where spirituality and science broke up. They never get seen in the same room anymore. They don't talk to each other. They argue over who inherited the rights to the children and to the future. And we have this world now filled with scientists who have no divinity in them, and the faithful who have no reason in them, mm. and unfortunately artists who have seems to be mostly neither reason nor divinity. And they're sort of kind of really, really lost on the corners. And I feel like it's kind of a schism of the human soul, and that there's going to have to be some sort of a remedying of that or a reconciling of that, because all three of those are probably the most fundamental aspects of what it means to have human consciousness, and they ought to be able to communicate at some level.
Within the book, Alma Whitaker, she develops her own scientific theories independently. They align very much with theories later presented by Charles Darwin. And she held out, I don't want to spoil it, but she had a reason for holding out, publishing her theories. And it centered around the question of human altruism. Can you talk a little bit about where that fits in to this discussion of spirituality and science?
Well, this is where the rubber sort of meets the road. This is the piece that we still, all these years after Darwin, we don't really have universal scientific consensus on what altruism is and why we have it as human beings in such extensive and sometimes self-destructive ways. Mm-hmm. Why do we put our lives out for other people? Why do we sacrifice what is clearly going to be beneficial for us or for our ancestors, for our descendants? You know, why do we do that sometimes even for perfect strangers, sometimes even for members of other species? you know, like it just doesn't add up from an evolutionary standpoint. And there are lots of theories going around about it, but it's a tricky one to solve. And Alma spends a great deal of her life trying to sort that out. And she has examples of her own life where people took enormous risks for her and made terrible sacrifices for her that she didn't even know about, that benefited her not at all. And so she's trying to reconcile her own her own guilt and marvel about that at the same time that she's looking at it from a scientific perspective. And she's unable to come up with a satisfying answer. And I think that that actually, as collectively, we are all still a little bit unable to come up with a scientific answer that's satisfying.
Right, it's one of those mysteries of life. And like
almost last one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really something interesting to ponder after reading your book. It's something that keeps surfacing for me. And perhaps it's in line with, you have Alma's mother say something really interesting during the book. She says, not everything has an answer.
Yeah.
She says that.
It's Alma's mother, who is a very pragmatic, stern, empirical Dutch woman, says that at one point to Alma when she's a child, and it blows Alma's mind to pieces because it's the first she's ever heard of this idea. She grows up in a house filled with people who are essentially scientists. And I think that I relate to her in that regard because I've spent my entire life searching for answers and believing that you can break the code, you know, that somehow you're going to figure it out. You're going to, like, turn the right combinations, and then there's never going to be any more problems. You're going to solve the whole thing. So it's an equation that makes sense, and I think sometimes the older we get, the more we realize that that might not necessarily be the case, and it might not be fair to the world or to yourself to expect it to go that way.
Mm-hmm. Recently, in the New York Times Magazine, I almost cheered when I read this. You said that you were honored to call yourself a feminist and that you were appalled that the word has become something that people flinch before they say. And you say, more than being a feminist, I'm like the winner of feminism. I won the results of their work. I would love to hear. You know, it seems that the term feminism is loaded, and that's why people flinch. They're not quite sure what they're, you know, signing on to.
Right.
I would love to hear your definition of feminism and how it has impacted your life story.
Well, I mean, to go with the question backwards, there's no level at which it has not impacted my life. I was lucky enough to be born in 1969 and not any moment before. There's no way I could have had the life that I've had in pretty much any other moment in human history. And the reason that I am able to have the life that I have is because of the very hard-won rights and powers that were given to women by the women who demanded those rights and powers. So I'm the recipient of this tremendous gift of grace that came from those women. You know, the fact that I have the right to have an education, that I have the right to a political voice, that I have the right to biological self-determination, that I have a right to a voice in the public sphere, that I have a right to travel freely without having to be escorted by a male relative everywhere I go. I mean, to have my own banking account, to have, you know, the list just goes on and on and on, to be able to publish my work under my own name, all of it. And so I think I get really, you know, I do sort of get genuinely appalled when I see women who are living the fruits of feminism but distance themselves from the feminist movement. I just think, you owe them everything. you owe them everything, and you must never forget what they did for you. It's madness to not call yourself a feminist.
You know, throughout the years, I've read quotes from you. You mentioned lovingly about your female relatives and how their lives were not as free as yours. They did not have the opportunities that you had. It made me wonder, is Alma Whitaker a tribute to those women?
Well, I do dedicate this novel to my grandmother, who just turned 100 years old 6 months ago, and it's not an accident that I dedicate it to her. The women in this novel are, none of them are based directly upon any of my female relatives, and all of them are based in huge ways on all my female relatives. I think that the most resounding and, to me, impressive characteristic of women in general is the characteristic of resilience. I always marvel at the fact that, you know, we still sort of see depictions of women as being helpless and being needy and in need of rescue and in need of protection, when in fact there's nothing more resilient in this world than a woman. Women are susceptible to tremendous suffering and disappointment, and they are able to manage tremendous suffering and disappointment. And the women in my family who got to the age of 100, my grandmother, have great wisdom and great strength, and they didn't earn it by having easy lives. They earned it by things going wrong and them rising to it and managing it and enduring. And I find that to be so powerful that I took my 14-year-old niece out to Minnesota a couple months ago so that she could spend some time with her grandmother, because I wanted her to see that. And I remember driving down the highway in the winter with her in Minnesota and sort of lecturing her and saying, this is who you come from. You have this in you too. You know, and I was listing everything that went wrong in my grandmother's life and how difficult her life was and the lives of her ancestors. And I was saying, you are the inheritor of all of their strengths, so you must never collapse. No, you're not allowed to, because that's not who we are. We endure. We're resilient. We're powerful. I know you're being picked on in middle school, but that's not going to kill you. You know, I was sort of like giving her a Vince Lombardi kind of feminist speech as we were driving down the highway. And in many ways, this novel is a celebration of that spirit, because all the women in the book have that in them as well.
And, you know, Alma's life was so constrained in so many ways, down to her clothing, you know. And it was just a beautiful testament. It just gave me hope that no matter what we as women are dealing with, even in this age of feminism and freedom, we are still so constrained at times. And you really convey beautifully that a life of the mind can almost be enough, or can carry you through. And in a way, it made me realize that the mind is where women have always been free.
The secretest organ in a woman's body, the most hidden and mysterious, is the mind and the brain, and the one part that nobody can ever completely take over, which I think is one of the reasons men have traditionally tried so hard to do that, because it's extremely alarming. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to write about a woman who finds her joy and her redemption and her meaning in her work, and she finds it at a time when women's work was not traditionally scientific. You know, it tended to be more domestic, which is not to say that it didn't also have its rewards and its powers. But Alma stubbornly refuses to lead anything less than an intellectual life, no matter what else might be going on. And as somebody whose life herself has been saved many times by the flights of imagination and work and creativity and productivity of the mind, I know that feeling very intimately.
Thank you so much, Liz. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed speaking with you, too.
Have a great book tour.
That was Elizabeth, just call me Liz, Gilbert, discussing her new fiction release, The Signature of All Things, and why she is honored to call herself a feminist. Thanks, Liz, and thanks to your publicist, Lindsay Prevett, and also Meredith Brooks and Kristen Ilardi at Viking Penguin Books for the arrangements. And I must thank KBOO's Kathleen Stevenson for help with recording, and Noah Talks a Lot for his help with the sound quality. Learn more about Elizabeth Gilbert on her website, www.elizabethgilbert.com. Coming up at 6:30, we'll hear an interview with Jackie Blackman Forche of Women Under Siege about the rape crisis in Syria and their live mapping of sexualized violence. And to round out this segment and to honor Dia de los Muertos, here are some spoken word pieces from In La Quech, an all-Chicana performance poetry group from Los Angeles and our former guests here on Bread and Roses. We're going to hear a couple of tracks from the Mujeres con Palabras CD, first Macho Meeting and then La Tonantzina.
Before we start, let's take care of official business.
Simón, que viva Zapata.
Firme que viva Villa.
Que viva César Chávez.
Que viva, órale, que viva Cuauhtémoc.
Que viva.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. Traffic was terrible.
It's all right, Xochitl. I thank you for your presence and for being a surviving brown woman in this society. Compañeros, before we forget, let us acknowledge la mujer.
Que viva the mother Zapata.
Que viva la madre de Cuauhtémoc.
The mother of Villa también.
And the mother of César Chávez.
So, Xochitl, What's up? Do you want to carpool to the matcha with me?
Aren't you going out with Don Ancin?
Que viva the mother of Richie Valens!
Don Ancin? Nah, that's been over since the boycott before last.
If that's not what Ischel said. Last week you helped her make posters one night and then went out and used them at the demonstration with Don Ancin the next.
And the mother of Edward James Olmos.
Ischel? She just wasn't the one.
Wait. Weren't you also dating Maya at the same time?
Oh, thanks for reminding me. I forgot to break up with her.
And all of the women from El Círculo Mujeres Chingonas de Aslan?
And the mother of that Chicano guy from Chips.
You don't understand. I'm still struggling to find my Aztec deity of love, Mayan Lakech, a strong sister to struggle with. You're the only true Mexica goddess I see around here. Come with me to the marcha. We'll discuss strategies afterwards. At the cafe, if you know what I mean. Mexica Tiawi?
No thanks. I'd rather take the bus.
Que viva the mother of Selena. Oh yeah, Selena! And the mother of Cheech from Cheech and Chong. Speedy Gonzalez's girlfriend. Cha-cha.
That was MC Tiawi. Yeah, with her rendition of Las Mañanitas. That was really good. I've never heard it rapped before. Okay, next we have an open mic. Give it up for Marisol Lidia Torres.
I am the woman, Earth Mother. They call me La Tonancina del Barrio Tepeyac. Tu Madre Tierra, Pachamama. With my fertile hips, what you love so much. Que viva my ovaries!
Que viva!
And everything else down there. I am the creator of life itself. Orale. I am the four directions. The north, the south, the east, the west, and the moon. La Luna, living on your pedestal, on my moon, paying for all of my evil sins committed against my brothers, Huitzil y Adán. Dispensa. I'm the mother of our children of the sun, El Sol. In my life-giving eggs, I contain our warriors and future super chicanos. Firme. I am la mujer. Que viva la mujer, which all of you born again Mexicas and Chicanos make pilgrimages to in order to pay homage and to give your respects to my four directions. Que no. I am la Rosarita, Señorita, Frijol, Refrita, Mexica, Azteca, Mayan, Princesa, Queen. A tu servicio, para servirte. Come and taste the sabor, my plenteous fruit of the fruit, as I bring forth my flowering, flowing milk, the leche, which does a cuerpo good. Qué tasty soy yo. Duality, it is I, the ultimate balance of life and death, fire and water, night and day, frijoles and arroz on your Acapulco combination plate. But not too many frijoles, because remember, I am duality, equilibrium, balancia. I am at one with the cosmos. Interrelation, menstruation, fertilization, pollination, implantation, ejaculation, insemination, impregnation. Ay, constipation, evasion, hemorrhoid, inflammation, procreation all within my womb. Like always, la mujer getting stuck with all the work. But it's all right, because the energy spouting off from my uterus, pues it gets me through my day. Ya tú sabes. I'm at one with the universo. Teteo, Ina, Xochiquetzal, Sihuacoat, Loquenahuaque, Ipanemowa, Iponemowa, Iponemowana, La Chica, Quién sabe? I'm all the beauty before and yet to come, personified into one personification. Mujer madre, sustenance and maintenance of la familia, the foundation of nuestra raza, la chingona, la jefa, big boss of la casa. I am the holder of the golden steel-toed chancla, sent down to me for generations by our mamas and kick-ass abuelitas in order to keep you traviesos, huevones, and troublemakers on check. Y no me enojes, don't piss me off. Because I'm the giver of life. And I can take it away. Way? And don't you forget it. The sun rises and sets with me. Are you still buying this? Oh, okay, pues. Yes. Okay, I am the fertilizer. I guess you can say I'm like the manure of life, spilling from my mouth into the front lawn of the universe. Simón, que yes. So the next time you flout to me or my sisters and honor the festival of our directions, do not say that you are here to protect your mujer from the wrath of the huasicho or lo que sea, and then impose your own selfish playboy wannabe methods in the name of the revolution inside of your pants. Because la mujer will tell you, chale tamale, del pastel manoite, guacho.
That was In La Quech, an all Chicana poetry performance group from Los Angeles. Up next, Bread and Roses member Delphine Crescenzo interviews Jackie Blashman Forché of Women Under Siege about the current rape crisis in Syria.
Welcome to Bread and Roses. I am Delphine Crescenzo. Syria is undergoing a crisis, a civil war, some call it. But Syria is also having a rape crisis. Jackie Blashman Forché is an epidemiologist graduate student at the Melman School of Public Health at Columbia University. She is the lead researcher for Women's Media Center, Women's Under Siege Project. Her research on sexualized violence in Syria has been highlighted in The Atlantic, The New York Times, and presented to the United Nations. Women Under Siege is a journalism project that investigates how rape and other forms of sexualized violence are used as tools in genocide and conflict throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century. Women Under Siege is highlighting how Syria has a massive rape crisis going on. They are collecting data through social media platforms in order to create a crowdsourced map of rapes happening in Syria. Here's Jackie Blashman Forché telling us more about the findings of Women Under Siege in Syria.
My name is Jackie Blackman Forché, and I am a student at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, and I'm also the lead researcher on Women Under Siege's Syria Project, which uses crowdsourcing to track reports of rape in the current Syrian conflict. So my primary responsibility is to analyze the prevalence of sexualized violence in Syria based on the reports that we've collected.
Can you just explain what is Women Under Siege, how this project was started, and what is its connection with the Women Media Center?
Sure. So Women Under Siege is a project actually through Women's Media Center, and it was originated by Women's Media Center's founder, Gloria Steinem. And Women Under Siege uses journalism to investigate sexualized violence in recent 20th and 21st century conflicts and genocides, with the hope that by increasing awareness of the issue, we'll also be able to develop a better understanding of its causes and means to prevention. And the name Women Under Siege is more obvious given what our work is focused on. Certainly we hope to be able to bear witness and give a voice to the countless number of women who have been sexually victimized throughout recent conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Do you are you aware of how Women Under Siege, the name, came about? I just feel it's so powerful.
I don't know like the direct story behind the name, I just think, certainly, given the focus of our work, it's certainly fitting.
Absolutely. And so the Women Under Siege has kind of like a two component. It's a project with two components. There is a public education plan, and then there's also an action plan. Can you talk a little bit about both?
Yeah. So the public education plan for the project as a whole is about public education through journalism. And by reporting on sexualized violence and conflicts, we hope to be able to demonstrate that rape is being used as a strategic tool in war and that it's not just a consequence of conflict. The action plan is hoping that our work can push for legal and policy changes that involve humanitarian rights networks such as the United Nations or international tribunals, specifically in regard to our work in Syria. We have both research and policy aims that would fit into this action plan. Our research aims are to develop a method for tracking sexualized violence and conflict in real time, to assess the prevalence of sexualized violence in the current Syrian conflict, and to identify where and what resources are needed for affected individuals. And with these in mind, our policy goal is to be able to provide data that can be used to help intervene and to provide evidence for war crime prosecution. And already our work in Syria has been presented to the United Nations, has been present throughout the media, has been presented to the White House. And so we're already seeing our research being translated into policy discussions. I would also add that we have an important kind of research methodology component of our work, especially in regard to the Syria project. This is the first time that sexualized violence and conflict has been tracked in real time, and we're using social media to do it. And so our research goal is to show that social media can be used as a methodological tool that's valid and can ascertain important data.
Can you talk about why is rape used as a tool of war, and maybe give some historical and political background as to the research that have been done around this?
Yeah, so the Women Under Siege website highlights 12 conflicts where sexualized violence has been used as a tool of war. Some examples of that would be in Rwanda, where sexualized violence was not only used to degrade women, but it was also used for ethnic cleansing. And an estimated 250 to 500,000 women and girls were raped during the genocide, which is an outstanding number. Mm-hmm. In Bosnia, also, rape was used for similar reasons. Women were raped in public, in daylight, to not only humiliate them, but to also force people to flee, to inspire fear among the population. And there were an estimated 50 to 60,000 cases of rape from the Bosnian conflict. And these are just reported were rapes, so it's not even taking into account sexual assault, groping, threats of rape, which is something that our work in Syria is also trying to collect data on. In Syria in particular, the war began, the civil war, which began in March 2011, and it's between the Syrian army, led by President Bashar al-Assad, and the Free Syrian Army, just trying to overthrow the government. And the conflict is even further complicated by outside groups of fighters, primarily Shabiha, which are plainclothes militia forces that are working alongside government soldiers. And the civil war is a humanitarian rights crisis. It's only getting worse. There are 1.2 million Syrian refugees, with even more displaced within the country, and around 70,000 deaths related to the conflict. And certainly, as our work has shown, sexualized violence is an issue as well.
You said that you use social media in order to track what is happening in real time right now in Syria. Can you talk in more practical way, like exactly what can women do in order to send you the information?
Yeah, I mean, this is the most novel aspect of our project. And it means that women and men as well, affected by sexualized violence in Syria, or who know people who have been affected, can send it reports to us using our CrowdMap website. The link is womenundersiegesyria.crowdmap.com, and we have a section of that website where people can submit reports. Everything is kept anonymous to protect the safety of our site visitors, although we certainly encourage people to take precautions. People can also submit reports to us on Twitter using the hashtag #RapeInSyria. We look for those reports and can turn them into data on our crowd map. And then additionally, we search the internet and YouTube in both Arabic and English for other reports that may not be directly submitted to us. And so we've seen reports from United Nations documents or Human Rights Watch documents that we've collected in order to create a central resource on all known reports of sexualized violence in Syria. But in this way, women have the ability to speak up about their assault in real time. And personally, it's very exciting to be a part of a group that is primarily women that's so dedicated to understanding and bearing witness to this cause.
I also feel then that's also a way to remove the possibility of policymaker to say, oh, we didn't know this crisis was happening. That's why we didn't do anything. We found it afterwards. Like on your website, you say there is a rape crisis in Syria right now. It's happening right now.
Right. I mean, most often sexualized violence and conflict is tracked years later. And this is problematic for number of reasons. One is that given that it's a conflict, women and men may be killed within the course of the violence, which leads them unable to report their rapes later on. Individuals may seek refuge in other countries. So they may not be attainable for research later on, or because of issues of shame or stigma, people may just not be willing to talk about what they've endured, you know, months or years later. And so by tracking sexualized violence in real time, we're creating a real-time discussion and hoping that it creates interventions that can help people, you know, when they need it, you know, soon after the violence they've endured has taken place.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious as how your focus on Syria has started. Did you guys receive reports and felt, oh, wow, something is going on? Or did you just start, you know, looking into the area and then found that indeed there was a crisis there?
Yeah, I think given that it's a current conflict, this was an opportunity to do this work in a conflict that was currently ongoing, and then we felt that we could make a difference in. It's harder to do this afterwards in different, you know, like I mentioned earlier, it's harder to do it to look at the Congo or to look at Rwanda when the conflict's already ended. And so we felt that this was a really innovative time to do this important job.
Can you talk a little bit more in detail about the crisis? What are the number and are only women affected?
Yeah, so as of mid-March, we've collected 226 reports of sexualized violence in Syria. And it's important to state that these are the number of reports that we're looking at and not the number of victims. Mm-hmm. Our reports don't list the exact number of victims, but we've certainly seen numerous reports in which people are raped together, often in detention centers or in homes. And so there would be more victims in these 226 reports. And although 80% of our reports are female victims, one of the important findings of our work is that men are also being affected, and they may require more unique interventions later on. That being said, among the women, 85% of our reports include rape, 10% include sexualized violence without penetration, and 10% of the reports include women being detained for at least 24 hours for the purpose of sexualized violence. And additionally, 40% of the reports with female victims include multiple attackers. So these women are being gang raped. Mm-hmm. Reported consequences of these assaults among females include pregnancy in 3% of the reports, anxiety or depression in 10% of the reports, and death in 18%.
Wow.
And some of these women are killed within the context of their rape. But there are also numerous reports where women commit suicide soon thereafter, often because of the shame and the stigma they feel, or because they're being disowned by their family.
So it seems that you are also getting reports from maybe family member of the victims who have died.
Absolutely. Family members or neighbors, people who are also in the refugee camp with them. And then, of course, among men, 47% of the reports include rape with penetration, and 16% of those reports include multiple attackers. And we've found that among men, rape is often being used as a form of torture within detention centers. So as women are often raped within their homes, men are being punished with rape while detained. There's also reports where men and women are victimized together. Whole families are victimized together. So a father may be forced to watch as his wife or daughters are being raped. And then that's sometimes followed by the rape of the father as well. So it's really everyone is being targeted to some degree.
And it seems that the aim of the rape in this context is really like create a climate of fear, I feel.
I think it depends on the situation. Certainly, I think part of it is just a consequence of the conflict and a consequence of chaos. But within detention centers where it's being used as punishment, certainly to create fear. There are cases of men who are being detained whose wives are brought in to the detention center just so that the husband has to watch his wife be raped by his imprisoners. It's, you know, kind of all around just a form of torture.
Absolutely.
But it does vary between men and women who are being, how they're being targeted.
And so on a map, what does that look like?
I think we've seen reports of rape throughout the country. If your listeners log on to our Crown map, they can play around with the document. Although there are certainly locations where we've seen the most reports of rape. Holmes, for example, has been a real epicenter of violence in Syria right now. And we have 71 reports that are kind of centered around Homs or that region. Damascus as well has about 54 reports that we've collected. But really the whole country is being targeted. And we've also had reports from refugee camps. So people leave Syria and they enter the refugee camp and they're still, you know, not completely safe.
And so do you have, I'm just thinking in terms of access to those technologies, are you trying to get resources to people so that they can also contribute? Or how do you put the word out also that you guys are trying to gather this information?
Yeah, so what's most important to us is that people are safe. And so there have been kind of cases of the Syrian government targeting activists by logging into their, you know, computers and kind of tracking what they're doing. And so we would never want someone to submit a report to us that would put them at risk from within Syria. And so in the region, we're relying a lot on the ground contacts, to kind of ascertain reports for us and then give those reports. So people who are working in refugee camps, or who may be journalists or humanitarian rights workers, have a bit more safety in reporting to us as kind of more of a middleman. We're also relying on Syrian, you know, expatriates who, through their Facebooks or through their kind of friend and family networks, can ascertain reports and get it to us that way.
Can you expand on the concept of citizen journalist and crowdsourcing? Because it sounds like this is what you guys are doing.
Yeah, so citizen journalism relies on the public to help report news, and there's been such an onslaught of it in recent years. As social media has grown as such a powerful tool to disseminate information and to form communities. And I think within the last 2 years, we've seen with the Arab Spring uprising that people on the ground who were just activists were taking videos and pictures and reporting about what was happening in their communities. And so in Syria, we've seen this by people who are reporting on the conflict and sharing it on their Facebook accounts, on their Twitter accounts, through Skype interviews. And Women Under Siege, we're collecting reports from social media. Like I said, we receive reports from the hashtag Rape in Syria. We also have numerous reports from Facebook postings or YouTube videos. where people have shared information that would otherwise never be known to the world.
So it's also an alternative to, instead of sending reporters on the ground, then you get the people in the country to report back to you.
Absolutely. And I think it's exciting because it creates, you know, a wider range of information that can come out of this conflict. It's not just anyone who has access to, you know, a cell phone with video capabilities can be a reporter and can share information. So I hope that it means that we're getting, you know, reports that would otherwise never be told, and we can therefore give a voice to that.
And so you said that some of the people who report are expatriates or human rights workers in the country on the ground. Do you also have people amongst that crisis who report for themselves?
We've seen less cases of that directly coming to us, although certainly a search on YouTube yields numerous videos where women, for example, are speaking out about their rapes, or there are videos of detained former Syrian soldiers being forced to say the crimes they've committed, often under duress. And so these videos kind of do show what's going on, although they're not being submitted to us directly. You know, anyone can find them on YouTube. And we've seen other reports. We've received other reports from a psychiatrist working with Syrian refugees, for example, who has worked with women and with families who have been victims of sexualized violence.
And so it seems that it's a taboo in that country in particular, speaking out about sexual violence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Given that it's an Arab country, a Muslim country, shame and stigma are an issue that surrounds sexualized violence. And that's one of the reasons we believe we're seeing an underreporting of rape, because women and men just aren't willing to come forward. We've seen reports, like I mentioned earlier, where women are disowned by their husbands or their families, or they commit suicide because of the shame they feel because they were raped. And then on the other hand, we've tracked a report, for example, where men in a refugee camp offered to marry a family of young women, of sisters, who they knew had been raped, in order to protect them from further stigma. So it goes both ways. But certainly the former is, you know, unfortunately, the more common route. And our hope is that by collecting these reports in real time, we can at least help to create an environment in which sexualized violence can be discussed, and so that interventions can happen more readily. But regardless, I think the shame and the stigma is a real barrier that is, you know, hard to overcome for us as researchers, and certainly, you know, challenging to overcome for the people who are, you know, currently living it in the country.
And who are perpetrating these violence? You said earlier that there was kind of like two sides of the conflict, the army and then the Revolutionary Army. Is that something that both of them are doing or using as a tool of war?
Yeah, so from the reports that we've tracked, we found that primarily the government is perpetrating sexualized violence. Mm-hmm. Among females, 54% of our reports have government perpetrators. And among males, that number is 91%. Shabiha, which are those plainclothes militia forces working alongside government soldiers, are also perpetrating a number of rapes. 20% of our reports among female victims have Shabiha perpetrators. 6% among male have Shabiha perpetrators. And so far, we've only tracked two reports that list Free Syrian Army soldiers, or those rebel fighters, as the perpetrators. We don't quite have an explanation for this yet. You could think that the government and their detention centers is using rape a lot. So that's accounting for a lot of the cases of rape. But thus far, it wouldn't seem that the Free Syrian Army is raping us frequently, only based on the reports that we've received. Certainly, there's a lot of information that we don't have. We can't make, you know, total overarching judgments about that.
And so what do you hope this map accomplishes when someone goes to your site and sees it? So for individuals, but then also at a higher level of policymakers or politicians, how do you think that this can influence the conversation?
I think for individuals, I hope it kind of just creates an awareness and a conversation about an area of conflict that is otherwise kind of not talked about. Or talked about later on. You know, when you turn on the news, this may not be what, you know, is being reported on by the media, but it's certainly still an important part of what's taking place. And, you know, will be an important part of Syria's recovery as we try to kind of understand and intervene with the women and men who've been sexually victimized. In regards to policy changes, I think there are important interventions that need to happen, and that we need to kind of create a safe environment, one within refugee camps that offers support and aid services to those who have been affected by sexualized violence, but also to hopefully intervene in a way that creates, you know, governments, United Nations, other international humanitarian rights networks to move towards stopping the conflict. And I think as researchers, you know, a goal is that we want to see that if the work that we are doing in Syria can be done elsewhere, and how could we translate our work now to use social media as a tool in other conflict settings or in other populations where sexualized violence is a problem.
Oh, that was actually a question I was going to ask. Do you have projects in, starting the same kind of crowdsourcing and map for another region of the world?
Yeah, they're not at the moment. Although I think that if we can kind of nail down our work in Syria, you could certainly do it anywhere. One project that my mentor and I have discussed is at Columbia University is trying to implement similar social media reporting among college students and to see if we could match the reports of rape that we would receive through crowdsourcing with already known crime statistics. Certainly that would be another population that kind of has an unfortunate high prevalence of rape. And it would be an interesting way to see how crowdsourcing and social media could be used among students who are already so engaged online.
And I think that this is absolutely right. There is an incredible amount of women here in the United States who get raped on college campuses.
Right, and who may not be willing to kind of report to their local government or their local police department.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if they could send out an anonymous tweet or kind of Facebook posting or email, would they be willing to kind of want that information to be known? So it's, and there's certainly a lot to be explored with this. And I think we'll see more and more social media being used and crowdsourcing being used to do research like this. I think it's really kind of, we're on the forefront of what's to come.
So how do you advertise? How do you let people know that they can report to you?
Yeah, so we've really been fortunate to be so well-received in the media, especially when we analyze new data. I think people have taken a real interest to it. Otherwise, our team is so active on Twitter, both in English and in Arabic. We're working with Arabic activists who are helping to translate reports for us, and so they can kind of key into their own networks who may be in Syria or may have family still in Syria to spread information. It's really kind of the power of how quickly and how easily, you know, news can spread online, the power of the online community.
Absolutely. And would you mention again your website if people want to know more about it? And then also there was a recent article in The Atlantic.
Yeah. So if the Women Under Siege website as a whole is womenundersiegeproject.org. And from there, you can link to our crowd map. But again, that link would be womenundersiegesyria.crowdmap.com. And we did have a recent article in The Atlantic, which lists our most recent data that we analyzed as of mid-March. And I think if people Google The Atlantic and Syria's rape crisis, they can be linked to that.
And I think there's also a direct link from your website.
Yes. Kind of all of our information on Syria is on the website. And we have a pretty good search tool, so users should kind of plug into that as well as read about the other conflicts where sexualized violence has been used as a tool of war. Because certainly it's not just, unfortunately, it's not just in Syria. It's kind of a whole history of it. We've seen so many similarities between what's going on now and what's happened, you know, in the past 10, 20, 50 years.
Thank you, Jackie, for joining us. Do you have anything else that you'd like to add?
Thank you for kind of including us in your program and creating awareness about this project. You know, I hope that your listeners can kind of get involved as well or kind of start a conversation with their own communities because that's where it really starts.
Thank you.
KBOO Portland, you were just listening to the end of Bread and Roses. We're going into Heart Knock Radio, so definitely stay tuned. News, views, and hip hop.
KBFA brings the listening public the other point of view.
There was a strong sense that this was the beginning of something that would spread across the country.
On Sunday, November 3rd, at the historic Hollywood Theater, KBOO presents an exclusive benefit screening of the film KPFA On the Air.
This documentary tells the powerful story of the beginnings of listener-sponsored radio in the United States with the birth of Pacifica in Berkeley in 1949.
KPFA On the Air chronicles the origins of the free speech movement, the first stirrings of the student movements at Berkeley, and opposition to the Vietnam War in the early 1960s.
Eventually spawning a network of free-form, independent radio stations across the country, including KBOO, which came on the air in 1968. So come join us at the Hollywood Theater, Northeast 41st and Sandy Boulevard, Sunday, November 3rd, at 7 in the evening.
Help keep community radio strong and thriving into the future.
Meet